Okay, so my listeners, so in this podcast, Aaron has his listeners, and I have my listeners. The interesting part is going to be to find out if we have any crossover listeners.
I'm excited for a crossover episode. Never done one before.
Yeah, me too. Me too, with two Circ podcasts. So for my people, like Aaron's a straps and like neuro physio dude, and I that's probably not the best way of saying it. What is the best way of saying it?
I studied neuroscience and psychology in school and did some research afterwards, but not like a neuroscientist. Would not claim that okay. by any means.
So he knows some more of the technical aspects of what we're doing. So I'm going to start asking Aaron questions first, and then we're going to see how this rolls. And I have a bean on my back right here. Yep, I have a bean on my back. Okay, so Aaron, obviously my population is mostly women. All aerial women, not tons of ground act stuff, lots of hanging from the sky, and women who are in all different stages of prenatal postpartum, wanting to have a kid, interested in what the process will do to their body and how that'll affect their aerial practice. Some are pregnant right now. Some were pregnant 10 years ago and have kids that are in the world and independent. And I do a lot of curation, a lot of storytelling, and you do a lot of like deep. Oh my God, she's pushing me off my chair. A lot of deep diving and stuff. So I want to ask Aaron questions that might be really interesting to this population. So, what would you say about your experience watching, working with, experiencing women who are in this stage? Like, do you come across in your community? And what's your experience with that?
For sure. I think from kind of an observational place, what I have mostly observed is starting out when I was first training in New York City at Circus Warehouse, one of the coaches there became pregnant and continued training on for quite a while. And I don't know exactly when in their journey they stopped training. And then more recently, I've seen folks like Chrissy continue training through a lot of the process, but because I typically tend to be a traveling coach or an online coach, I don't necessarily get as much observational data because I'll go to a place for a week or 2 weeks and do some workshops. And usually the content that I'm offering is kind of a level of intensity that I think someone who might be at a certain point in their pregnancy journey would maybe shy away from because of how dynamic intense it is. So I would say that subjectively, I haven't had as much exposure to pregnant aerialists as probably you have just with your podcast listeners and interviewees. But yeah.
Okay, so it makes sense because with pregnancy, I often say it's a process of elimination and subtraction. And then when you come back, you can build. But it's not a building phase for people. It's a maintaining phase, and it's staying with it so they can go back to it. So that being said, let's talk about weight training because I have a CPT, a certified personal trainer, certification, and I do not use it in any type of way, like at a gym, because I cannot stand the gym. What are some things that are prenatal? So they have a bun in the oven. Let's talk about that and what maybe some advice, some tips that we can share with those women on best ways to weight train, what kind of stuff they're going to want to do, what kind of stuff they want to stay away from maybe.
For sure. So one thing I just want to caveat with this whole episode, this must be included, is I'm not a pelvic floor specialist or an OBGYN or someone who can literally ever become pregnant in my current physical state in this universe. That said, I will reference the research and the OBGYN Association's guidelines and do my best to synthesize it practically for aerial, for weight training, etc. One thing that I'll say is that we don't have a lot of really good research and data on weight training and pregnancy, but also on, especially on Ariel in pregnancy. Even the research that we do have is often referenced as kind of like low quality evidence. And then more recently, for example, there was an observational study that came out among CrossFitters, which involved some weight training. But again, it was observational. And part of why that is that if you're trying to get research approved by the IRB board, or that's redundant, but the IRB, which is essentially the organization that essentially says, hey, you can run this research and it can be published, et cetera. Their primary goal is to make sure that participants won't be harmed. So to run a randomized controlled trial, they have to kind of know already that any intervention or experiment you're going to run won't hurt the people in it, ideally. So something like an observational trial where people are going to have data about them collected, people who are aerialists, this could be done with, and I really hope it does someday, but with CrossFitters, they essentially had CrossFitters who were either going to get pregnant, being like they were currently pregnant, or they had been pregnant, and they're asking them a lot of questions about, you know, how long did you continue training? What type of training did you do? When did you stop? If you stopped, did you have any complications? And collected data from that, because that way they weren't asking people to potentially put themselves in what could be a harmful experimental group compared to what is ideal when you're running research, which is no one is harmed. Obviously, that's not always the case, but for the most part, I just want to caveat that our research understanding is still evolving. But when we come to weight training, and I really encourage everyone listening to look at the guidelines published by the American Council of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, is that movement and training is good. Like, I think we can agree just generally as a society, I think for the most part, that some level of moving your body is important, and moving your body, lifting heavy weights is good, especially for aerialists. But obviously there are factors we want to consider when it comes to pregnancy, like we'll probably talk about a little bit later, different hormonal changes, if you have more or less relaxin going on, and how your relaxin levels might be residually elevated even after pregnancy. But the things that the American Council of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, or obstetricians and gynecologists, recommends is that folks be wary of very heavy resistance training. So this would be like 80% of your one rep max. If you're doing aerial and not weight training, that could essentially look like a movement that you can just barely do one or two times. And then beyond that, you're like, I can't do this anymore. Supine, so lying face up exercise, and we'll talk about why that's a little bit risky, and or potentially risky, and the Valsalva maneuver, which depending on who you ask is probably worth avoiding anyway. And that's where you're essentially like holding your breath like this, and you're bracing with your diaphragm and using your diaphragm as a core and kind of bearing down. So heavy resistance training, so that 80% of your 1RM, and the use of Valsalva are cautioned against due to concerns about extremely large but potentially transient increases in blood pressure, with fears that these acute increases in blood pressure might harm the fetus. So that's something that is cautioned against. Again, we don't have randomized controlled trials saying this for sure will have this issue or this won't have this issue, but that's one of the guidelines. And then heavy resistance training is also cautioned against because there are concerns about injury risk, right? During pregnancy, if we have increased laxity of tendons and ligaments with higher levels of relaxin, that can be a risk factor for ligamentous and tendinous injuries. Supine exercise, or face up lying down exercise, is cautioned against because the weight of the fetus might compress blood vessels in the abdomen, so the inferior vena cava and the aorta, and that can result in hypotension, so really low blood pressure for the mother, and reduced fetal oxygenation after that. May is the key word. So one thing I just want to say is if we think about aerial and circus, even outside of resistance training, there are a lot of positions that we might want to also avoid considering those potential risk factors in terms of compressing those same blood vessels by the added weight of the fetus. If we think about anything that we're lying up and pregnant on an apparatus, like a back balance on trapeze or on hoop, that could put some weight on those blood vessels. And then similarly, with C-shaping or waist rolling or waist wrapping skills. I don't think we have any data on this, so this is definitely conjecture, but I would say that C-shaping probably puts quite a bit of pressure on those blood vessels anyway, maybe even more than a 10-pound baby would, or like 7-pound or however.
Aaron, looked at your thing. You have this whole thing on C-shaping. I know nothing about this terminology. Are you talking about flexion or extension?
So C-shaping, like, great interjection, because I think I am at a point where I assume people know what I mean. Doesn't necessarily mean that everyone does. It's super fair. It's essentially the act of resisting gravity by rolling up or down your apparatus, or in place if it's a horizontal apparatus, moving through four C-shapes, which would be forward flexion, lateral flexion or side bending, extension, and then lateral flexion on the other side.
Oh, so it's all four. I love this. And listeners, I wish you just saw him like physically demo this for me.
Not that they get to see it. I mean, we could put this on YouTube, but that's more work.
Feel like there should be a reel of you like, have you seen those ballet pictures where oh my God, I have to send this to you. The ballerina has like nude colored tights and a leotard and a black dress on, and basically brings the black tube dress over her head so that it covers her arms, and then she's just shaping. That's kind of what you did, except not as pretty.
So I like that as the metaphor or the visual. Okay. The visual that I usually give is kind of more like, you know, those like wavy car dealership.
That's what you just looked like, dude.
Yeah, it's this. Like, no joke. Okay. And I will fully embrace that I didn't look as pretty as a ballerina, because not one. But yeah, so that's what it is. And when we're doing that, especially when we're wrapped tightly, whether rope, fabric, straps, or even on a bar, we're potentially, again, this is conjecture because I don't think we have actual evidence of this.
Correct.
And if we do, someone please let me know, because I would love to know that. I would say that that probably puts way more pressure on the vena cava and the aorta than a 10-pound baby would. But when we're doing this ourselves, even if that does change our blood pressure, either dropping it down or increasing it, I know when people sometimes they C-shape, they have increased intracranial pressure or like a lot of pressure in their head and skull. It can happen.
Okay.
Yeah. And some of that can be about breath and again, Valsalva, et cetera. But if we're doing that ourselves, it can be problematic for some people for different reasons. But if we're doing that and there's a baby that we have to consider, that's where it'd be like, okay, that's a whole nother story. So the three major guidelines are don't go super heavy or intense, whether it's weightlifting or aerial. Don't bear down Valsalva or don't do supine exercise. Those are the guidelines. We don't have that for aerial, but that's what the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommends. And you can, like, again, I think people will make the choices that make sense for them. One thing that I want to add, though, is that, like I mentioned earlier, there's that that observational study of CrossFitters who essentially they continue doing CrossFit throughout their pregnancy journey at different periods of time. And what they kind of found was that there may be lower levels of risk for some of those things than we might expect. It doesn't mean there's no risk, and that doesn't mean that it's not worth attending to or caring about those different potential three risk factors. But there weren't like huge high rates of, tendon and ligamentous injury among people who continue doing CrossFit while being pregnant. We'll talk about pelvic floor issues probably a little bit later. And there weren't a large number of reported cases of potential issues for the baby or the fetus. But that doesn't mean that I'm saying ignore those guidelines. I'm just saying I think we just don't have a lot of clear data yet.
Yeah, it's really hard with the testing. Even when I was pregnant and I was like, can I take this over-the-counter medication for like my gut issues that I've had, pre-pregnancy? Mm-hmm. They were like, well, we can't say because we have no studies. I'm like, yeah, but you can't say it's dangerous because for anything, they basically have to get a bunch of women, pregnant women, that will be guinea pigs for a particular drug or a particular movement. And that's really hard to get because why would people want to risk that? So I think that we're, you know, that's a big reason why I have this podcast, is because, you know, all we have is anecdotal evidence for so much of this. And then, you know, we kind of take our community of knowledge and what happened with this woman and that woman. So for sure, I don't even think that a lot of these pregnant aerialists are, I don't think they expect to find any studies necessarily. It's just like they want to hear from other people who've gone through it, and they want to hear from people who have a certain amount of knowledge. The thing that came across my mind when you were talking about these contraindications, people have said to me in the past, not even aerial based, my Pilates trainer, actually, my master teacher, the person who teaches teachers, to avoid pressure into the knee pits during pregnancy. Now, how does that fall for you?
That is something where I would say I would have to look into that a bit more. My guess is that if that guideline is based in something medical, again, I didn't see that in the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists recommendations. Maybe the idea is that there are veins and blood vessels closer to the surface there that putting pressure on could have a similar impact on blood pressure of the mother and the fetus. But I would say that there are things that used to be said in the past, and we have kind of slowly and gradually seen a broadening of what's considered safe for pregnant exercise. Mm. So for a while, like the idea was don't weightlift at all when pregnant. And now it's like, actually, you probably can. It's just don't lift super heavy. Don't hold your breath and bear down weirdly. And don't do lying up things in case you happen to, well, one, the baby on the aorta. Two, if you happen to like drop the bar that's like loaded heavily on your stomach. So that's my take on the knee pit question, is I don't have a good answer there. And if it was coming from some kind of theoretically scientific mechanism of action, maybe it was coming from the same idea.
Yeah.
But
yeah, kind of blocking those blood vessels and those lines. Okay. So I have recently interviewed a Pilates trainer about prenatal Pilates, and she prefers to do planks for her pregnant women as a core exercise, because it brings the weight off of the entire body. You know, the baby's hanging down. But then you will find, if you go a very quick Google search, that a lot of like people who are talking about prenatal are like, no planks. And so are you in one camp or the other on that? Just by the way.
I'm going to go. Yeah. Well, I would say that if we think about the potential like risk factors I already mentioned, it's not included in there, right? It's not like, in a plank, you're doing any of these things. Now, maybe someone's saying no planks because it's putting more pressure on the low back, or it's like putting more pressure on tissue that's already weirdly more elastic, like in your abs. But or maybe the fear is that the person falls, like it just gives up in their plank.
I'm not entirely sure there.
My general take with almost all of the debate around, or the discussion around different types of weight training and Pilates, etc., is that the principles of good weight training and strength training and physical training still apply before, during, and after pregnancy. So when we think about what those are, even if our body is changing, the principles still matter. So I don't want to have a sudden jump in training intensity, in training volume, in training load, in training range of motion. And I really importantly want to like make sure that I'm listening to the signals that my body is sending me. So how long am I staying sore relative to how quickly I'm recovering? Am I experiencing a type of discomfort that is beyond just muscle soreness? Those are things that I think are, because we don't have good data, like you said, whether it's for over-the-counter drugs for pregnant people, or whether it's for a clear randomized controlled trial of doing planks versus not doing planks for folks who are pregnant, I think the ideal is using those principles, using the principles from the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, and then combining that with the data that you are getting observationally from yourself. And fingers crossed that you have good internal awareness and good interoceptive awareness of what's happening in your body, because if you don't, that makes it harder to kind of synthesize all three of those factors together.
Yeah, it's so interesting what the internet will give you, because like, I do think that some of that advice is like, oh, but you might fall on your baby. And it's like, okay, some people might, but my population is not going to fall in a plank on their belly. Pretty much. I mean, you could never say 100%, but like, pretty much that's not going to happen. Not worrying about the pregnant phase.
He looks like the Ghostbusters guy.
He looks like the Ghostbusters guy?
Yeah.
Which one? The son or the older guys? The Stranger Things guy?
No, I mean the Ghostbusters.
The Ghostbusters. Oh, yeah. Oh, Egon Spengler. Do you look like Egon Spengler?
I don't know who that is.
He's the scientist with the glasses, obviously.
Well, I used to have glasses. I can see some resemblance there. Okay.
Well, I mean, she's four.
Yeah, no, look.
I mean, she probably sees white man, Egon Spengler.
My partner is a pediatric occupational therapist, and some of the kids that she works with will request certain musicians. And one of the kids is like, I don't want the old ladies. And when this kid says old ladies, they're referencing like Jada Pink's daughter or something.
Jada Pink's daughter, like, Willow, who is like 18 or 20.
Yes. literally. Because the kids are kids bop singers.
Right.
So it's like the old is anything above kids bop. Anyway, but yeah.
So, okay. Yeah, there's our standards there. So not worried about the prenatal and the postpartum. Let's talk about pelvic floor health. I feel like it is one of those things that women are sorely uneducated about, even though we all have one. Men have one too.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, for sure. I have been to a pelvic floor specialist. This is not a brag. This is because I think it's like a learning experience, but we all have them.
We and
it's
important all have to one. Them. And to like completely be like, I don't want to hear about this. Private parts. You know, it's part of our body. And for us, it's a part of our body that we use constantly. And if it's not working well, that's when we are having problems, right? It's not really when it's working well, because then everything's going, the engine's running. Nobody questions the car that works perfectly, right? So
sure.
Can you talk about just general pelvic floor health, things that we should know, you know, for the regular population, and then maybe we'll get in the weeds with our pregnancy women?
Those
are big questions, I know.
It is. That is a huge question. So one thing I'll say is I if anyone is listening and hasn't listened to the episode I did where I interviewed a pelvic floor physical therapist, I highly encourage you to listen to that, because that is their bread and butter, and they do that all the time. But generally, we have a number of pelvic floor muscles. The names don't matter, because you'll forget them, and or it just doesn't really matter what the names are for now. But when we have pelvic floor muscles, they can be kind of in a optimal muscle tone state of being. They can be hypotonic or super lax, which we can talk about when it comes to pregnancy. They can be hypertonic or kind of super tight. And generally, there is a potential for pelvic floor complications, challenges, however you want to call it, where people can have, and this can occur outside of pregnancy, urinary incontinence, anal incontinence, and organ prolapse. And that also is definitely a pregnancy issue as well. So that's what we typically would look at. There are a lot more issues that I think can come with it in terms of like pain during sex and other things in the not bodily function region of pelvic floor health. But yeah.
I've actually come across some cues that I like for doing a like a great textbook inversion with pelvic floor exercises in mind. And the one I like for my pregnant women is, I'm sorry, just women in general, but like the cues that the women are going to use when they're on the ground doing all just the breathing.
I like, would say people in general.
Yeah, for people inversions. People in general. So what I have, and you can let me know if you have anything to add to this or take away from this. I like the analogy of a trampoline. Pelvic floor or blossoming flower for the ladies, maybe, where the breathing is, the inhale is the relax and letting the trampoline kind of bounce down without tension. And then as you exhale, trampoline bounces up, transverses abdominis, comes in, everything goes in and up, and that's when the legs, and you're going to do your straddle inversion, legs super wide, and feel like the pelvis is curling up to the ceiling with the exhale breath coming to the top. Is that in the ballpark of what you do, or is that totally different?
So that's, I would say, a pretty solid like starting point,
oh,
I think,
I
for a lot
mark.
Of folks. Again, not a pelvic floor
yeah,
specialist.
Yeah, me either. But like, what kind of pelvic floor specialist is going to know the ins and outs of the inversion, like a straddle inversion too, right? So we kind of...
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
For sure. But I would say like, no matter sex, gender, etc., if you're lifting up and you're getting a feeling that you're contracting so hard that you might like pee yourself or poop your pants, you're probably doing the wrong thing in terms of potentially going back to that Valsalva or just bearing down too hard in general. Now, if someone is getting those good cues that Carrie just said and is still having trouble kind of finding that imagery and applying it in a movement, that's probably an indication that the movement is too hard for them right now. Doesn't mean they should never do it, but if I am applying so much load in a certain movement that I can't not like hold my breath or that I can't not bear down super aggressively, it is probably, when I say too hard, it is just more load and pressure than our abdominal core musculature, pelvic floor, transverse abdominis, obliques, and diaphragm can handle. And then it might be worth kind of practicing a floor progression or practicing with a little bit more assistance or something.
Are there any things you would add to that? Like if you had a client and they were not necessarily struggling so hard, but maybe the coordination wasn't there. Is there anything you would add to that if you were in the room?
For an inversion?
Yeah.
I think when it comes to... especially pelvic floor muscles, but muscle activation and engagement in general, my earlier career self would have been super specific about what muscle to engage when, at what time, and how hard. And what we, I think, have a generally good sense of in terms of the research overall is that that's not as helpful as we think it is from coaching a movement perspective. So if I'm like, all right, you need to really, really like contract this pelvic floor muscle at this point in the movement, I don't think it's going to help someone. So I would really focus on getting them to try to feel that feeling and sensation that you said of like, sure, the trampoline, as we inhale, it lowers down. As we exhale, it comes back up. And then if they're not sure about that, I would have them like feel it out in their bedroom at home. Like you can feel that no matter what body parts you have. I can, if I do that, I can like, okay, I can just put my finger by my butthole and that's still going to give me the same information. It is.
You know, Aaron, I feel like we're in the same world, you and I. Like, that's the answer I would give. And I feel like sometimes as a teacher, like now I'm very like open about my ways. I'm just like, I'm going to get yelped somewhere. Somebody's going to hear the word anus one too many times and be like, this is inappropriate. But I don't think so. It's our bodies. Who cares?
Yeah.
We got it. We got to, you know, call it the name.
I think so. The one thing that I would kind of potentially encourage people to do is obviously, like, not all of us can access a pelvic floor specialist either because of availability or money or time. But if you have that option, that's something that's worth potentially exploring. If you feel like you're having any challenges with breathing during movement, with core contraction during movement, and or with just pelvic floor incontinence, et cetera, anything that can kind of come with pelvic floor complications, because it's something that I think, for better or for worse, it's really hard to know what pelvic floor muscles you're contracting and how hard, and if at rest they tend to be more contracted, or if at rest they're super lax. Whereas, like, if I look at your lats or if I feel my lats, I can immediately be like, yes, my lats are contracted, my lats are relaxed, my lats are contracted, my lats are relaxed. But I think it's a different story when it comes to pelvic floor muscles.
So what I've learned anecdotally from all of my interviews, because we talk about this all the time, is that there's a high instance of hypertonic pelvic floor among aerial females. Not sure about the males. I would say
let's probably, like, generalize a little bit to all people doing high intensity.
Yeah. Okay.
I would just, it's probably changing over time, but even just thinking about how, like, hollow bodies are taught in a lot of earlier on circus places, just the way that it's taught can impact pelvic floor muscle tone.
Yeah. So we are already kind of, like, just statistically higher that we're going to be super tight in our pelvic floor. I'll tell you my personal story that my pelvic floor was so tight throughout my 20s, 30s that I thought I had UTIs and they were not. Mm-hmm. And then I took antibiotics, totally eviscerated my gut biome. And then, you know, like, the OBGYN is like looking at my symptoms, they're not looking at the cause necessarily. And I learned this through just anecdotal, like, talking to my friends, talking to people who are in this world. So this is what I've heard happening a lot. We have a woman with a very, very tight pelvic floor. They are seeing a regular OBGYN and being given the advice to do Kegels. Very common. And then just making a contracted muscle never relax ever, which then cannot function and makes it weak, makes it tight, right? So then you have woman who has been potentially doing Kegels versus, like, actually learning how to, because also, like, I wish maybe some physical trainer, personal trainers are already doing this, PTs are already doing this, but, like, if you're gonna do the Kegel, you have to learn how to do the relax too. It's like turning on a muscle but never turning it off. So maybe, you know, woman X is doing that and then goes to have a vaginal delivery. Hey, did you finish your breakfast? Look at that. Goes to have a vaginal delivery and, like, for lack of, like, scientific words, like, blows out their pelvic floor and then ends up with pelvic organ prolapse because they were too tight, could not stretch like the way our hamstring might just blow out if you don't stretch it and then you really stretch it. That happens a lot for the people that I'm talking to, Aaron. Make it stop.
Well, unfortunately, I cannot. But I will say that's kind of something that I was alluding to earlier when I was saying, like, we can have hypotonic muscles and hypertonic muscles. And generally among the kind of, like, recreational to elite athlete population, we'll probably see things that tend towards hypertonic. Now, I will say that it seems like there's a possibility where a lot of muscles in someone's pelvic floor could be hypertonic and then some could be hypotonic. But if we're making it a general observation of what I've seen, it's like probably tending towards hypertonic in general. Now, I think that the tricky thing is that if you look at the literature that's out there, first of all, as a recent meta-analysis by Wu et al. State from 2018, which is one of the more recent meta-analysis that I could find, essentially they straight up say it remains unclear whether like postpartum pelvic floor muscle training improves pelvic organ prolapse symptoms because of very low quality evidence and more high quality randomized controlled trials are needed in this area. So what we know is that even among the populations that are getting research done on them, there's not enough research. And then among elite athletes and aerialists in particular, there's pretty much just anecdotal data, like you said, and you're noticing these trends. And so if you look at the pelvic floor training protocols, so one from Sutton Kaplan in 2015 essentially says like pelvic floor muscles should be contracted by pulling inward as with urine or gas output and held for 10 seconds. Following 10 seconds of contraction, the muscles should be completely relaxed and this contraction should be performed a total of 10 times. That's something that I think is actually like an okay protocol because it highlights that it should be completely relaxed afterwards. Now, I think there are probably people putting information out there where they're saying, all right, you just got to contract really hard and contract really hard. But as an example, when I went to the pelvic floor specialist, the hard part was the relaxation, not the contraction. And that's something that you need to really like learn what that feels like. And sometimes it's helpful to have outside input. But there's something to be said for if the protocols that are in the research and that people are getting trained on and or are repeating are highlighting that relaxation, that's a good thing. And then if people are kind of just saying, hey, Kegels, 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 and not highlighting that the relaxation could be the part that's challenging, then we might be running more into the problems that you're seeing or the challenges that you're seeing.
I do think that, you know, the time that I've gone to see a pelvic floor specialist, they did like encourage me to do it the right way. So maybe what we're talking about are just like, it's like the noise out there on the internet. Because I think there is good guidance out there. It's just that we're not necessarily getting it.
Well, the benefits and joys of the internet is that people will make sweeping generalizations that don't allow for the nuance or the complexity of a protocol. But yeah, one thing that I would say is that in general, if you can't access a pelvic floor specialist and you can't get someone to tell you what you should do for your pelvic floor pre or during or post pregnancy, or just in general, if you're an aerialist who's having pelvic floor challenges, is I think that it's possible to practice. And like any muscle, if I'm lying on my bed at rest and I point my toes and I engage my glutes, I should be able to ideally relax my plantar flexors, the muscles that point my feet, point my toes, peroneals, etc. And I should be able to relax my glutes with ease. If I stick my finger in one or both holes that I have, depending on what's going on, and I cannot do the same thing after the contraction, that's probably something worth practicing. If contracting is hard for me and I can't feel the contraction around my finger, then that's probably worth practicing. So I think even if we can't afford to, we can still do a little bit of kind of self-testing to give ourselves some guidance of where we might be tending, whether hypotonic or hypertonic, and how we could prioritize any focus time we have on our pelvic floor.
You know, one of the most learning moments in my life was losing my pelvic floor connection after my pregnancy, because she was a C-section and when I went back to training, the muscles, the pelvic floor muscles, were not automatically recruiting like they did before. And this has to be trained. And so I made a huge mistake. Well, I don't know, it was a huge mistake. But I think this happens to a lot of aerialists. They get really like impatient. I mean, we are not a patient bunch. And I was just wanting to do the things. So I did them. And what was happening was my body was just recruiting whatever it could, because those pelvic floor muscles were not really responding. So like I was training incorrectly and me being a pretty knowledgeable person, even I made that mistake. Then finally saw a pelvic floor specialist and went to PT and, you know, would do the exercises. Basically, I could do the contraction if just laying on my back, 2 feet on the ground, knees up. The moment she added movement to my exercise, like, for example, extend one leg, knees still together, and then do a small circle with the leg and do the contraction. Unbelievably not happening. Not happening. So I was like, what are the chances that I'm doing a way bigger movement like a straddle inversion and that pelvic floor is also participating? Zero chance. And then, of course, I did the PT and then it got better. But that was an eye-opening moment for me because I was like, well, I can do the pelvic floor contraction laying here. And then, progressing through those exercises where I would like make the circle bigger or like just add another movement slightly more complex and then see what my brain body connection did, and it would shut off right away. So thoughts on that?
Again, broad question. I think one thing that you can see sometimes when people are having trouble with abdominal core control, which I think I'll lump a little bit pelvic floor muscles into. They are based in our abdomen, and I would say they have some relevance into some of what's going on in terms of breathing and core stability, is that, like you said, they were recruiting kind of on their own naturally before your C-section, and then afterwards it was a little bit hard to get them to re-recruit. I think the progressive kind of work of starting small and going big makes a lot of sense in terms of, hey, as soon as I add this little leg circle, it's not happening. I would also say that there are times when our muscles, and this is a general statement, but if we look at core muscle activation, I'm not talking about pelvic floor muscles here, just core muscle activation, so transverse abdominis, et cetera, obliques, rectus, et cetera. If we are doing something like a deadlift or a squat or running or picking something up, if we don't have something that's going on that is impacting the neurological control or like literally something in our brain, maybe we had TBI, or maybe we had a period of time where there was no nerve connection or muscle damage, etc., and then they don't work the same way anymore, that can happen. But if things are going well and we are doing a deadlift, doing a squat, etc., those muscles should contract automatically. And telling ourselves, okay, hey, I have to contract my TVA, if things are moving well, it's going to contract when you lift something heavy, when you pick up something heavy. It doesn't mean maybe it's contracting at the same strength as something like your external oblique or your rectus abdominis, but it will contract. If we look at, you know, EMG studies, etc. For pelvic floor muscles, I don't know how much automatic contraction we could get over time from just basic movement. So I think doing something like you did where you started lying face down or face up, and then you added a leg circle and then a bigger leg circle, etc., is probably worth the time if you have the time. But there's a chance that maybe over time you would have relearned those pathways just through daily walking and movement anyway. I'm not saying you shouldn't have done that. I'm not saying you for sure would have, but I think we don't have, again, enough compare and contrast data on, okay, someone's doing pelvic floor training after a C-section versus someone is just walking after a C-section, and the time duration for them to recover kind of quote unquote normal pelvic floor muscle connection.
You guys are seeing in real time why Aaron has to work way harder to podcast than I do.
Yeah, sure. Also, I think this area is really tricky because there really isn't a lot of research out there. But I want to interject really quickly, and maybe you put this at the beginning or the end or something. I think Aerialists. There is a large enough population of aerialists, especially pregnant aerialists, listening to your podcast and also just out in the world, maybe listen to my podcast, etc., where we could probably collect a shit ton of observational data of people who are either pregnant, have been pregnant, or are going to get pregnant, and look at kind of the same questions that the CrossFit study looked at with CrossFitters and pregnancy outcomes and, you know, adverse events, etc., and get observational data that could be statistically analyzed to provide a little bit more specific research. Like, I don't know if any university is going to do that, but that data could be collectible. I hope someone does it. And if I get impatient enough and have enough free time, like, we could collect it. This is
so wait, Aaron, are you also a research scientist?
No. So like I am not affiliated with any academic institution by any means at all. My background, psychology and neuroscience. After university, I was like a assistant project manager of this research project. And then I went to San Francisco and I helped very little, like not for super long because the PI moved up to Vancouver. But I helped with a research project looking at the effects of the CDC recommended guidelines of exercise on chronically stressed people. And their blood work and their telomere length. So the telomeres are the little caps at the end of our DNA. And the chronically stressed people were caregivers of Alzheimer's and dementia patients as a model for chronically stressed people. So I'm absolutely not a researcher or research scientist. I have done research in the past, but currently I make a podcast and coach circus and...
You know, yeah. I'm going to make a leap here because I don't know you well. It's just this hour that we've been talking. But in my mind, you could probably get a PhD and do this because you seem like you would kind of be on that road anyway.
It's possible. Maybe someday. But PhDs take a lot of time. And as I mentioned earlier, I am extremely lazy. Okay. I'll reframe that. So. I'm lazy about the things I don't want to do. So if I want to do something, I'll do it. And if I'm not, I won't.
Right.
But academic institutions have a lot of like
red tape,
bureaucratic red tape and all this stuff that I almost went and got my doctorate in physical therapy. And then I was like, man, but I'm going to be annoyed. And that's fine.
Yeah. I don't even have the first inkling. So I give it to you because I'm not that I have a lot of interest, but it is not in all of this. I want to like know the answer, but like the process of getting answer is not exciting to me.
It's not exciting. No, it's not exciting.
No, it's
terrible.
Not exciting.
It's really slow and it's boring. So the reason why I would ever do research is because I am impatient for an answer.
Oh,
not because I like the process. I don't think any researcher actually genuinely likes the process. Well, that's a very big generalization. I have a friend who is a math postdoc and he loves research because it just means he gets to think about math all day. I personally just want to know and then I want to tell people so they can improve their lives. So it's an impatient thing. I would love to like sit here and collect the data, but I could do it. Anyway, the only addition I was going to say was just like, encourage people to continue moving their body and exercising during pregnancy, because that is, I think, super important. And we know that, right? Like the CDC recommends that moderate physical activity is safe for you during pregnancy. It can help reduce risk of gestational diabetes and keep, you know, your heart and lungs generally healthy. And then also exercise, as I think a lot of aerialists know, can help with mood and with reducing symptoms of postpartum depression. So just encouraging people that if you kind of follow the guidelines recommended by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, obstetricians, and the CDC, probably keep doing aerial and the movements you love for as long as you feel comfortable and safe. And please talk to a pelvic floor specialist, physical therapist, and just keep moving. That's all I wanted to say there.
So listeners, we're going to put a bookmark here because we could probably talk for 18 hours. But my bean does not have the bandwidth for that. So we're going to put a bookmark in this. But I have to say that, Aaron, if you ever decide to do that study, I am totally here to support you. And we can just put it out on the airwaves. and find every single, and there's also the Facebook group for pregnant and postpartum aerialists that I get a lot of my guests from. Like I hit people up all the time. And also the other thing I've been learning is that there's no shortage. There are so many people I have yet to even, yet to even like know about, find out about. Like every day I go on Instagram and I look through stuff and there's another woman who is like on her third pregnancy, aerialist, whatever, and they're doing it all. There's no shortage. So the world is our oyster, Aaron.
I think this is something definitely worth talking about further, the observational data collection and study. And if there's enough motivation between the two of us, we can reach out to the people who ran the other study and just kind of see if they're down for us to borrow the data collection tools they used. One thing that I also really want to like highlight last, because I should have said this first, for anyone who is an aerialist, pole artist, circus artist, or just athlete and wants to listen to someone who I think is probably one of the most science-based researchers and science communicators around women in sport and everything that comes with that, hormonal changes, et cetera, et cetera, please go check out Lauren Colenso-Semple's work. She is a strength training coach, but also a PhD researcher. And I think she does a really good job clarifying all the nuances that sometimes get either under clarified or kind of cautioning against jumping to too large a conclusion and then over assigning meaning to something that maybe we don't have enough research on just yet.
I would love to talk to her. And then also in my mind, and I might be wrong about this, but I think the Circ Doc did or was part of a study with pole dancers. And I have to go look at that again. So Dr. Emily Sherb, who
Emily is great.
Yeah, I'm sure. Who doesn't know Emily? Who knows Emily?
It's true.
In this world.
I've never met Emily in person, but
I haven't either, definitely, but like online. All right, Aaron, it's been a pleasure. Let's go offline and organize our lives, but this is great.
Thank you for having me on, and I hope that was a useful best interpretation of the literature and research and guidelines for folks who are listening.